Hello there, and welcome to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. I'm not Josh Arnold, I'm Rick Moore. Josh Arnold is here. Are you here?
I'm here.
He's here. Josh Arnold is here. Our producer and engineer is Bill Proposky, and we are gearing up for, this should be a pretty cool show. We got you got guests all across the spectrum today. It's awesome.
Yeah, Jenny Donahue is a candidate for city council in Newburyport, followed by Noah Carter, who will be talking about three generations of the Carter family that runs the Cupboard restaurant here in Gloucester. Third guest is Jared Eigerman, also a candidate for Ward 2 Council re-election in Newburyport. And Josh Turner will round things out. He's a Salem City Councilor from Ward 5 seeking re-election.
And we should mention, if it sounds like you have something like a bottle in your mouth, you do have something in your mouth?
I have some new teeth here. Yeah.
Oh, this is and you've had surgery recently?
Yeah.
Okay, well, so that's why you sound like you have a little bit something in there, and that'll clear up, I'm sure. But you're still you. I just want everybody to know that you're not chewing on something in here. Okay. All right, so... Good. We look forward to that. And I have to mention before we go to our first break and before we get to our interviews, we're getting a little concerned about this first anniversary concert to benefit Open Door. This is a music fest that MSO News Sports and Unfinished Music are putting on. Greg Verga's Unfinished Music Studios has had a number of, or they have a studio, not studios. He's had a number of guests over the last year. And many of them are going to perform on August 27 from 4 to 9 p.m. at the Mile Marker 1, 75 Essex Avenue in Gloucester. Now, this is a concert. It's a music fest. It's just going to cost $10. Tickets are available at the door, but we'd like to see some response online as well. You can purchase your tickets ahead of time at unfinishedmusic.bpt.me. I have no idea what that means, but it's unfinishedmusic.bpt.me. And Greg also tells me that you can just go to music.bpt.me. He's got it there. Unfinishedmusic.bpt.me. Grown paper tickets. Grown paper tickets. You can Google that and then look for us, okay? So some of the acts that we're going to have on August 27, it's a Sunday at Mile Marker in the great big tent, and there will be, of course, a cash bar on hand. There'll be food available over at Mile Marker. We have local original music, and some of the bands involved: Satch Karen's Band, Pier Avenue, John Jerome Band, Stolen Lions, Dan King, Brian King, Sasquatch Cohen, Pratik Podar, Inga Berga, Alto and Small, Black Sheep Stampede, and of course Greg will be the MC. It's going to be a great, great day of music. So again, go ahead and order your tickets, $10 a piece ahead of time, or available at the door again, Sunday, August 27. Email msonewsports@gmail.com, msonewsports@gmail.com. If you're interested, let us know. Okay, we will take our first break of today. And, hold on. I just got a correction from Greg. Brown paper tickets. Brown paper tickets, not grown. Spell check changed it. Okay, thanks, Greg. Brown paper tickets is where you go to order these tickets online. I love technology when it works. Okay, we'll be back with Josh's first guest in just a minute. This is Trending Now with Josh Arnold on MSO News Sports.
Score early and often this fall with a low-rate residential loan from the Institution for Savings. The Institution for Savings has fantastic rates, low or no fees, great service, and prompt turnaround. Plus, we service our mortgages in-house, so help is always a local phone call away. For more information or to apply online 24/7, visit institutionforsavingsloans.com or call us at 978-462-2344. Institution for Savings, member FDIC and DIF, equal housing lender.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're thinking of replacing the windows in your home, you should look at the Anderson Woodwright double-hung insert window, which comes with rich wood interiors in oak, pine, or maple. Quite simply, Anderson is the most trusted window in America. That's why we've been selling them for 57 years. Please see the Anderson Woodwright windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber. We measure up.
People come in, take a seat.
You're really in for a treat at Sylvan Street. Great place to eat and drink and meet with family and friends at Sylvan Street. We'll treat you right, day or night. Satisfy your appetite. Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street.
game with friends, meet for lunch, cocktails after work, or a romantic dinner for two. Whatever your plan, plan to do it at Sylvan Street Grill in Peabody and Salisbury. See you at Sylvan Street.
Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our first guest is Jenny Donahue, who is a candidate for City Council in Newburyport. Jenny, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you so much for having me, and good morning to all of your listeners.
I want to usually start out with our guests and give us your 2-3-4 minute bio, and then we can get into some questions.
Sure. So, yes, my name is Jenny Donahue. I am 38 years old. I was raised here in Newburyport, one of eight siblings, so I'm from a big family. My brother and myself are both legally blind. I'm a mother and a wife. My husband is Patrick, and my son is Oliver, who is 6 years old and attends the local public elementary school. I am a former manager of Turtle Alley Chocolates in Salem. There's also, I think you might know, the store in Gloucester, and that was my world for a good 10 years. Really just a background in the service industry and in small business management and retail. I guess that's in a nutshell,
okay.
A quick bio.
And now you were appointed by the mayor, confirmed by the Newburyport City Council, as part of the Newburyport Commission on Disabilities. Can you share with us your work on the commission?
Sure, yes. I submitted my request for appointment about 6 years ago when I met with the commission at that time, which was only two members, and it was apparent that they needed some help. So that is when I joined, and I mostly had focused on helping to recruit new members, build up the commission, which I have been able to do for the most part, though we are still seeking new members. Some of the work that I've been able to do since I've been on the commission, one of the first issues that I addressed was sort of the lack of knowledge that the commission existed. We put together a brochure. I spent a long time working on that, creating that, and pooling resources for that brochure of state and local agencies for people. We had that mailed out to the entire city via the city survey that goes out each year. Other things that I started to delve into was addressing handicap parking abuse, which is rampant, I think, statewide, countrywide. There doesn't seem to be any limitation on that, but what we were able to do here in Newburyport was we approached the city council to adjust the fine ordinance, which was rather outdated. It, in fact, didn't even reflect the current fine. But we did have that adjusted, and the fine raised a bit. And we also purchased all brand-new signs. We had new signs designed for all the handicapped parking spots to include that there is a fine amount involved, with the feeling that, you know, seeing that monetary number as a possible, you know, repercussion of taking those spots illegally, that would go a little further than just the sign that says not to park there.
And that
was a pretty involved endeavor.
and there's a standard, isn't there, for handicapped parking in terms of number of spots you're supposed to have if you're if you have a parking lot. I believe it's like 1 to 25, or it may even be.
Yes. So basically, that standard is pretty much in place here in Newburyport. There really were no lots municipally that didn't have the appropriate number of spots. You are correct that for every 25 spots, there should be one handicap accessible spot. So in the bigger lots, you'll see anywhere from 3 to 6, depending on the number of total spaces. Another little bit that's attached to that is that there also needs to be one spot that is van accessible, which is different because it does include the sort of zebra stripes you see in the back and on the side of those spots that allow for loading and unloading of passengers in wheelchairs. And the stipulation for that is there must be at least one. So if a parking lot only has 25 spots and they only have one handicapped spot, that one spot must be inaccessible. So we did our diligence to make sure all of the lots had the appropriate amount of spaces. Again, not an easy endeavor because it really wasn't written down anywhere. We physically had to go out and count all the spaces in the entire lot and then determine if we had the right number of handicapped spaces. There are still some issues I have with parking on the waterfront. All of the handicapped parking spots are located in one corner, and technically they're supposed to be at every point of access, which they're not. But the waterfront parking is an issue that is a bigger issue in the city, so it hasn't really gotten tackled to move those handicapped spots accordingly, because the fate of the general parking down there is still to be determined.
One of the issues that is happening in different places on the North Shore is as cities and towns get into upgrading their sidewalks and making them handicap accessible, they have to increase the width of the sidewalk in most cases. And what some places are finding is the roads are getting narrower. And it's if you have sidewalks on both sides of a city street, you may lose a few inches. But what you're seeing is more up on ramp, off ramp areas. So if someone's in a wheelchair, they can access the road or what have you. And that's, you know, for an old New England town that has macadamized cow paths, that's a big challenge. But it's happening gradually.
Yes, it's definitely been a very slow, gradual progression of attacking that, because you're right, in New England, that is a much bigger challenge than in a lot of other U.S. cities that are not very old. Of course, many of the New England towns have very narrow sidewalks, so that, of course, becomes an issue when they do need to go in and reconstruct it to make it wider, make it code compliant. The curb cuts, or ramps, as they're known, that is also an ongoing project, sort of never ending, because really every single corner, every single crossing needs to have that wheelchair access. Otherwise, you have folks basically stranded on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
But one of the issues that came up that was sort of by default is once they started creating these curb cuts on all the corners, it, you know, it allows for access for people in wheelchairs, but what it inadvertently did was allow for danger to visually impaired pedestrians. So a person who is blind, who's depending on their stick to find the curb to know when they're at the edge of the sidewalk, that curb is now removed, and they don't realize they're walking straight into the road. So then what has been put in place are what we see more often now popping up. They're these sort of tactile pads. They're called truncated dome pads, and those are those sort of metal, you know, pads with the bumps all over them. That is specifically designed to alert a person who is blind that they are now at the edge and about to go into the street. So there's been some contention around that, because when they're not installed properly, it can also inadvertently create something of a barrier to a wheelchair user, or at least some level of discomfort going over those bumps. But when they're installed the right way, it is a little more fluent and not such an issue. But it's tough to straddle the different challenges for different disabilities. So while curb cuts and truncated domes are considered best practice, they're not in the regulations that the building codes go by. That is changing. There are new regulations that are hopefully going to be adopted soon that address more specifically public rights of way. But the curb cuts, they are required, but they don't always happen. And basically, the requirement is that if a road is being worked on or a sidewalk is being worked on, regardless of how close it is to the corner, they are supposed to then outfit that corner with a ramp if there isn't currently one. Unfortunately, though, it just doesn't always happen that way. But we've worked pretty good with our DPS department to really make sure that those types of things aren't slipping through the cracks and not happening when they need to. Of course, sidewalks are a pretty big issue in, sure. in the city of Newburyport, like many old New England towns, but especially one that's laden with lots of bricks and lots of sidewalks that have fallen into disarray over the years. There's so many, it's hard to sure. tackle them all.
Moving to some other questions, we have a few more minutes to go, and city councils tend to be, you're running for city council at large, and city councils versus a mayor. You know, most charters have a check and balance system. A strong mayor appoints people. There's people that are subject to approval by the city council, hence a check and balance. But there's some built-in institutional rivalry of sorts. What are your thoughts about that, and how well would you say that the current city council works with the current mayor, and how do you see that relationship going forward?
Well, that's definitely a tougher question to answer. I don't know that there really is a very definitive answer. I do feel that the city council really does need to work well with the current administration in City Hall. When you have a divide, it certainly makes it a lot harder to get things done that need to be done. But I think that transparency has a lot to do with it. The sharing of all information is very important. I can't really speak to the current mayor's relationship with the city council because I'm not part of the city council, but from my understanding, it hasn't always been the most fluent. And there certainly have been some, I think, issues of contention between the two over the last few years.
And, of course, you have Bob Cronin, who's a member of the city council, who's challenging the incumbent mayor. So there's also that to add to the equation.
Right, and it certainly would make one assume that maybe the city council, you know, isn't necessarily happy with with everything the mayor has brought before them or has attempted. But again, I can't really speak to the relationship that I'm just not a part of yet.
Okay,
I just don't have the experience there personally.
The city has a website, and I guess a question I'd ask candidates is how much does a city website contribute to the dissemination of information? Is it updated? Is it functional? Does it help people navigate their way through government, the array of city services, and so forth? And you know, what could be done better if you have an idea?
Well, I think that all of those things are definitely very important. The website is, you know, in this day and age, is the fastest and easiest, most convenient way to get updates from the city. I know that the mayor does try to keep it updated and keep the more pertinent pieces of information or projects right on the homepage. But, you know, I mean, I think there's always room for improvement and growth with anything of that nature, just because the tides are always changing, and I think a lot of folks do depend on the city website to provide updates of, you know, current things when there's parking bans and things like that. You know, it's important, you know, to make sure that stuff is getting updated on a regular basis, you know, as things come up. I think we could do a little bit better, but I think for the most part, we're probably in a good spot, you know. But again, I think there's always room for improvement on anything online.
Well, thank you. I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold. We have a full crew here, and I have to go to my next guest. But thank you, and very, very best wishes to you in your campaign for a member of the Newburyport City Council.
Thank you very much. Excuse me. I appreciate the time and opportunity, and thank you very much.
Take
care. Have a great day.
Yep, bye-bye.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're replacing the windows in your home, please see the Anderson 400 Series windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, or Plaistow, New Hampshire. The Anderson 400 is attractive, durable, energy efficient, and reasonably priced. Remember, Anderson is the most trusted name in windows. See the Anderson 400 at any of our three locations. That's North Reading, Beverly, or Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Harrington's Trophy and Awards has been rewarding the North Shore for over 25 years. Hi, I'm Kevin Harrington.
And I am Marty Harrington, and we are known for our local family business, providing custom trophies, plaques, screen printing, embroidery, and much more. We offer a variety of services such as engraving wedding gifts, medals for charity walks, youth sports trophies, and uniforms. From the newest style performance wear to your everyday work shirts, we are your one-stop shop. Whether it's a fantasy football, warm-up suits for your team, end-of-the-year banquet gifts, or recognizing excellence, we pride our business on our exceptional customer service and quality products. Located in Lynn, or visit our website at harringtontrophy.com.
People come in, take a seat. You're really in for a treat at Sylvan Street. A great place to eat and drink and meet with family and friends at Sylvan Street. We'll treat you right, day or night. Satisfy your appetite. Eat, drink, and chill. At the Sylvan Street Grill.
Catch a game with friends, meet for lunch, cocktails after work, or a romantic dinner for two. Whatever your plan, plan to do it at Sylvan Street Grill in Peabody and Salisbury. See you at Sylvan Street.
Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold, and our next guest is Noah Carter. Noah, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Josh.
Well, Noah, you are part of what, third generation of family?
Me and my brother are the third.
Third generation of family that's run a local restaurant here in Gloucester. It's open from the spring to the fall, or right around Labor Day or whatever. And there's always a mob there. I mean, it's a takeout, but there's also a dining room to eat in and an ice cream place. Tell us about what it's like growing up in the Carter family and coming north from, is it Georgia?
Yes, sir. Georgia. Okay. It's about Austin, Georgia. Well, to be honest with you, it's great. You know, we get to kind of experience, you know, the best of both worlds. We get to avoid the snow in the wintertime being down south, and we get to avoid the, you know, the heat that's down south right now when we're up here for the summer. And, you know, it's fun to be able to get away and come up here and meet new people and, you know, and serve food and be in the beautiful city of Gloucester for the summertime. And, you know, it's we're a very close family, so it's nice being able to work you know, beside my brother and my mom and my grandmother and my grandfather all these years, you know. So it's great, really.
What are some experiences you'd wish to share with the listening audience about you know, growing up in a family that, you know, commutes 1,000 miles or so to Gloucester and all that?
Oh, well, you know, it's been different. It can be difficult sometimes. You know, it's kind of like once you start getting really good and settled in, seems like it's just time to pack up and move. So it's, you know, we got to load up everything, you know, and it's a big responsibility to make sure everything's secured in both places and everything's off and packed up, ready to go. It's, you know, it's a constant change. You know, it's a 23-hour drive, start to finish. If you just go at your own pace. And a lot of times I fly now, you know, when I'm by myself, because it's a 2.5-hour flight versus a full day drive.
Yeah.
You know, and having to leave your friends, you know, all that stuff that you get used to, your job or whatever that you have down south, and come up here, you know.
Sure. Now, the restaurant business itself is a full-time, almost a 24/7 business. Talk to us about what it's like working there and what that involves.
Well, you know, a lot of people, you know, they're like, oh man, you guys get to be on for 6 months out of the year, you know. But I will be honest with you, we put our time in while we're here, you know. But I'm sure, you know, you're a customer, Mr. John. You know, we are here all day long. Every one of us is. We're fully responsible for all of our prep work, our cleanup. At the end of the day, we cook the food from scratch. We serve the food. Me and my brother and my mom and dad, we are in charge of the deliveries, the ordering. We're responsible. You know, we have to go, you know, up the line or whatever to get more supplies or more food. You know, it's it can be really hard. We put our time in here. It's like you said, it's almost a 24/7 thing. We're here from first thing in the morning before most people are going to work, and we're here, you know, often 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night on busy days. You know, it's a lot to do, but we get to rest when we go back home. You know, it's kind of a, you know, you got to give in order to get. You know what I mean?
There's also, a weather element to your business as a takeout operation, and I know when I worked in the school department years ago, we took over the beach concessions, and on a hot day, 85, 88, 90 degrees, and this is 20 years ago, you'd do $5,000-$6,000 volume.
Right.
So I'm guessing 80, 90 degrees, the day starts early and ends long.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is an old building, you know, we don't have air conditioning, you know, so in the kitchen on those days, it's rough. And as far as business-wise, you know, we're right here on the water, you know, and there's a nice park, and the park will be really busy, but a lot of times the heat, if it gets in the middle of summer where it's really, really hot, it can be stifling, and it will be slow, you know. But on those days, typically, you know, we have umbrellas and stuff for people to sit up under, you know, up, have some shade and all, and they come and get ice cream and stuff. That's usually the most. Ice cream does a lot of business on those days, and people in the park, they want to get a cool treat, you know.
Sure.
But it's entirely weather-based, you know. Well, if it's cold and rainy, we can shut down better off, you know, because it's no one comes down to the park to go to the beach or look at the water when it's cold and rainy out, you know.
Yeah.
And then if it's a beautiful day, then we just go nonstop all day because we can't, you know, it's so packed.
No, this is Rick Moore. I'm a co-host with Josh, and nice to meet you. You have what I consider to be a very, very unique business that is totally representative of the Gloucester coastal community. It's just amazing. And
thank you.
You have, and the place is, to paraphrase Yogi Berra, nobody goes there because it's always crowded. It's tough to get there, but I got to tell you, when you get there, it's worth the wait, number one. Number two, you have a great blend of fast food, if I can use that term, plus terrific seafood. And you just mentioned all the hours you put in under pretty extreme conditions from time to time. And I know that you're packed on weekends and this time of year.
Sure.
But listening to you, I wonder what the secret is, because you must have a great pride, you and your family, in what you do and putting out the product you do, because you see the results every day.
Yes, well, you're exactly right. That's what it comes down to. You know, we're here because we know, we're here every day because we know that we're going to do it right. Whenever we send food out, hand food out that window for our customers to eat, we want it to be just as good last time as it was this time. So we're hands on. Everything's made from scratch. If it don't come out exactly perfect, it ain't. It's not going out the window. In our eyes, we mess up. Now we're only humans. We mess up all the time, way more than we wish we would. You know, but exactly. That's what it comes down to. It's just the pride. This is our livelihood. This is how we make our living. You know, everything we have came out of this place. Off my grandparents and my parents, and now my back. You know, so it's pride is what it comes down to. That's what we have.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that I hope that you get a chance from time to time to take a 10-minute break and look out onto the harbor, because that's going to be a spectacular venue to work into when you're stuck in the kitchen and so on, and then you look out what your customers get to see. You got to have some value in that.
Exactly. That's really what it comes down to. Often throughout the day, when we slow down, you know, on our slow times in the middle of the day or, you know, whatever in the mornings, I go outside and look at the harbor all the time because we're very lucky. There's a lot of restaurants in Gloucester that have good views, and I consider ours one of the best. You know, I'm looking at it right now, actually.
Okay.
Well, I've got about a minute left, but now, when do you actually usually come up here? Is it April or May?
That kind of depends. You know, see, my brother has graduated college, so he did the same kind of thing. I'm in college now, so my time up here kind of varies. But my parents, they usually get up here. Depending on, you know, sometimes they have some more stuff to do to open than other years, but they usually get up here like the last couple weeks of April, maybe, and then open up the last week of April or the first of May, and we'll stay open till last Sunday of September, maybe the 1st of October, something like that, just until when fall really starts to kick in, we usually call it.
Yeah, great. Well, I know, as Rick said, there's always a line there, and it's a high, you know, a high move, a very quickly moving line. I mean, and the variety is great, and you know, there's so much of the economy in this city is tourism, and it's weather dependent, and mm-hmm. It's seasonal. Like the population in this town almost doubles in the summertime. So I'm glad you guys have made such a good run of it. And when I'm done with my show today, I will be there for my usual Friday my Friday stop. So I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold, and I'll really? See you in about an hour. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The Gloucester House Restaurant at historic Seven Seas Wharf, 63 Rogers Street, Gloucester. This is owner Lenny Linquata.
We provide service and product better than anybody else. It comes directly from our boats right to your plate. We have fishermen that work great for us. We are wholesalers that we buy what we want to serve to our customers, and we put the rest of it right out in the market.
The Gloucester House Restaurant. Visit thegloucesterhouse.com.
This is the freshest seafood you can get from our boats to your plate.
The Institution for Savings has always believed in giving back to our communities because our communities are such great places to live and work. Last year alone, we donated and pledged more than $3.9 million to local nonprofits, including local hospitals, schools, food pantries, art organizations, and more. Named one of Boston Business Journal's top philanthropic companies, we are proud to be your local hometown bank. InstitutionForSavings.com. Member FDIC, DIF, Equal Housing Lender.
Many aspects of estate planning are interrelated, and you can turn to attorney Bob Andruga for full-service estate planning to help you develop a comprehensive plan in providing for your future. Bob will work with you through the years to adapt your plan as needed, and he can assist you with managing wills, trust, probate, and taxes. Visit the law offices of Robert J. Andruga at 128 Main Street, Gloucester, or call today for an appointment at 978-283-6883.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is Jaron Eigerman. Is it Eigerman or Eigerman?
Eigerman.
Eigerman is a current city councilor in Newburyport, representing Ward 2, and is a candidate for re-election. Jared, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, we usually start out with our guest and say, give us the 2 or 3 minute bio, and then we'll get into some questions about the about your work on the council and the upcoming race.
Okay, I'll try to keep it short. So I was born in Newburyport, so this is my hometown, but my parents split almost immediately, so I have another hometown, Cambridge, Mass. I lived in North Cambridge half the time and Newburyport the other. I studied city planning and law and have a joint degree. I started my career out in California, so back in 94 I went out there for grad school, and I was there about 13 years. And then I moved back home about 10 years ago. I first got involved in local politics here when I discovered that Newburyport, which of course is well known for historic character, didn't actually have any historic preservation laws except for one residential block, just one. So nothing downtown was protected anymore. There had been an urban renewal plan that expired 12 years ago. So that's when I first got involved, and I thought, okay, we can do better than that. And for a living, I do development work in Boston. I had done it in San Francisco, and now I do it in Boston. Usually very large projects, a lot of them historic renovations, like the old warehouse buildings by the Children's Museum on Four Point Channel. And so I lent that expertise to the council. I first ran in 2013, and I've been in office almost 4 years now.
Great. great. Now, city councilors represent the legislative branch in a strong mayoral form of government, and you have an elected mayor. There's some, by charter, some institutional rivalry or friction because of the checks and balances. How does that play out, and how would you assess the relationship this city council has with its current mayor?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, our new charter, which went into effect right when I took office 4 years ago, says explicitly, you know, all legislative power is in the city council and all executive power is in the mayor. So the rules couldn't be clearer cut. Some other cities, things are muddled a little bit more. Our relationship has not been great of late, I'll be honest. And I think because the city council has felt that we've been unable to get information as quickly and as complete as we would like. So, for example, we have been asked to take a temporary easement on some property, an old golf course, where we wanted to do some drilling for water. And, you know, the mayor's office has, you know, they run the show. They're the operational side. And, you know, we took some action on that eminent domain order, and we didn't have the complete information. We had to come back and do it over again. So there's been some frustration, but, you know, that's how it goes.
Okay. Marijuana is an issue in some cities and towns across the Commonwealth. With the change in the law, it can be used legally for recreational purposes. What impact does that have on cities and towns, and particularly Newburyport, in terms of permitting, zoning, and enforcement?
Okay. I'll tell you, honestly, I don't have any, you know, moral objection or policy objection to marijuana's legalization. You know, the people of the Commonwealth spoke, but I voted against the initiative last year. The reason being because I didn't like what it said about taxes. I think it's set, it's a bit of a trick. It set a cap on sales tax for marijuana on the retail. The reason I care about that is not because I'm looking to cash in for the city, but because there are impacts that are associated with retail marijuana. So in Newburyport, our concern is this. So far as we know, there's really only one bank in the New England region that will handle transactions for marijuana business, and that's because of the stigma, and it's still under federal law.
Sure.
So as a result, there's a lot of cash transactions. Cash transactions lead to crime oftentimes, just because it's easier to do robberies. So those are the impacts that we're not sure we're going to be able to mitigate easily, because we don't have the ability until recently with the state legislation to have our own surtax to cover those costs. I mean, our police have enough problems right now dealing with the opioid crisis and so on. So those are our concerns, are mitigating the impacts, not any kind of moral issue. And mitigating impacts means money.
Okay. Very well. Very good answer. What social media is something that happens more and more with candidates running for office, as well as candidates who get elected to office. How do you use social media in the context of your campaign, and how have or might you use it in a as dealing with your constituency in the ward?
Social media is a tool that I think we have to use. Like, there's a certain segment of the population that doesn't use all of the platforms. So Facebook essentially appeals to middle-aged people like me in their 40s, 50s, 60s and above. But what I'm finding is that people in their 20s and 30s really aren't on Facebook. They're on Instagram, and it's all sort of a visual, you know, it's all photos and pictures. And I'm not on Instagram, and, you know, there's only so many things you can do. I mean, we don't have a staff at city council. You know, you're on your own. So I'm on Facebook only because I'm in office, and I find it's a good way to communicate with those older voters. A list that I assemble, and, you know, that's kind of catch as catch can. You get the word out and ask people to join on. But, you know, social media is what I'm saying, is it's not a panacea. It's a necessary tool. You have to do it, but it is not the be-all, end-all. Some of the traditional stuff you still have to do.
Good. Very well. The city's website, cities are more and more using website as a drawing card, something that showcases the assets and the services of a city. How would you assess the effectiveness of the Newburyport, the city of Newburyport's website, in terms of its content, in terms of its reach to people, in terms of its being updated on a fairly regular basis, and how is it doing in terms of reaching the broader public as well as the voting public in Newburyport?
I think it's pretty good. I mean, I do a lot of work with websites, like a lot of people in business, especially with the City of Boston's website and other cities where I have clients doing development work. You know, you need to be able to download all the regulations. You need to know what's going on. You need to get all the notices. I think our city's website is pretty good. You know, so I don't think it's a disaster at all. I think it was updated in the last 3 years to a more readable style. I do have a criticism, which is that, unlike in a lot of other places, and it may be budgetary, but it's a priority we need to make. When an application comes in for a project, you know, it really should be scanned and put up on the website quickly, you know, so that people can get that. You really shouldn't be requiring people anymore to drive down to City Hall and look at the paper records. You know, it should all be posted, and we need to do a better job on that.
Okay, great. Infrastructure issues, construction, Newburyport's had its share over the past few years. I guess a couple of parts to the question I'd ask. One is, what's of those projects that have been done in the last few years, as well as anything that might be in the being done now, how has that worked, and how have you been able to coordinate the impact issues of that construction to the extent that it impacts your ward area?
Yeah, no, that's something that actually in the last two sessions of the City Council, we have two-year sessions, we've been working on. And we're kind of in the dark ages on that in the report, I'll be honest. You know, so, for example, on sidewalk repair, you know, one problem, of course, is always is having enough money. You know, you can't, it's very expensive to keep up city infrastructure, as all of your guests will tell you. But we weren't giving notice, you know, so sometimes, you know, neighbors would come home one day and find their sidewalk was dug up, and they had no idea that was happening. So we only in the last 2 years have changed the ordinance to make sure the notices go out to all the abutters so they have a heads up. So that's one mold that we whacked. But another example would be we had a horrible smell problem with our wastewater treatment plant down on the riverfront. It was caused really by the connection to Plum Island. That's a whole other story. But people were suffering terribly in the summer from the smell when Plum Island was being heavily used. And so, you know, the city did the right thing, and they said, all right, this is a moral imperative, and we floated a bond. You know, the debt is there, but we did not do a great job of warning residents of how the trucks were going to come and go for that project. So there was a crisis of a sort of in the last 3 weeks, where people noticed the signs going up for a temporary truck route, and they saw a bunch of big trucks rumbling down their streets, and understandably they were wondering about it, and mainly wondering, well, why didn't anyone tell us? And so we have to do a better job on that. We don't have the rules in place, and we don't have the custom.
Okay, great. In terms of construction going forward, what isn't in the queue that you think should be? And just briefly chat with us about that.
It's actually the big picture study. You know, so there are some things that we just know we had to do and we've done, and they have been in the queue, and we bit down hard. A good example would be we have a force main that's, you know, a couple miles long that serves the west end of the city, you know, the sort of post-war suburbs on the west side of I-95, and then has to come all the way through the old downtown, go over a ridge, and then, you know, so it has to be pumped up a ridge, and then it has to go down by gravity to the wastewater plant on the river. And so, you know, our staff was monitoring that. They realized the pipe was out of round, so it was going to fail. And proactively, we floated the bonds and we did the work. So we've been good recently, because the city is more able to absorb the cost, respond to these emergencies. I guess what we're not good at is we don't really know our total capacity. So the City Council actually appropriated money in March for a study to say, all right, look, how many gallons of sewage are we processing today? How much more can our infrastructure handle? And if we're expecting more development, how will we handle that? And same for water. You know, and it sounds very elementary, but we don't have those background studies in hand, and that's very frustrating to the city council because, you know, we're asked, okay, you need to float a bond for $6 million, and we say, all right, well, is this going to fix everything? Is this going to mean we have enough capacity to handle new development? And frankly, staff doesn't have the answer.
Yeah.
So that's the hole in our infrastructure work is the info.
Okay, great. Well, I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold and very informed answers to some really important questions concerning Newburyport. Certainly wish you the very best of success in your election bid, and we'll hope to talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Score early and often this fall with a low-rate residential loan from the Institution for Savings. The Institution for Savings has fantastic rates, low or no fees, great service, and prompt turnaround. Plus, we service our mortgages in-house, so help is always a local phone call away. For more information or to apply online 24/7, visit institutionforsavingsloans.com or call us at 978-462-2344. Institution for Savings, member FDIC and DIF, equal housing lender.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're thinking of replacing the windows in your home, you should look at the Anderson Woodwright Double Hung Insert Window, which comes with rich wood interiors in oak, pine, or maple. Quite simply, Anderson is the most trusted window in America. That's why we've been selling them for 57 years. Please see the Anderson Woodwright windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is Josh Turiel, the Salem City Councilor from Ward 5, is an incumbent and seeking re-election. Josh, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Glad to be there.
We usually start with a new guest and tell us, give us a 2 or 3 minute bio, and then we can get into some questions about the work you've done on the City Council as well as the upcoming race.
Okay. Well, I'm a 27-year Salem resident. I'm a professional IT consultant and a amateur politician.
Okay.
That's the simplest version of the bio. I run a tech company based out of here and work all over the region. I've been on the city council for 6 years now, winning my first one election in 2011. And I'm married and have a high school sophomore.
Oh, great. That's wonderful. What city councils tend to be, by charter, a check and balance to a city mayor? Kim Driscoll is your current mayor. And, you know, how is that tension, if you will, of institutional rivalry or a check and balance, how does that work? Do you find it works smoothly, or is there more tension at certain times in Salem? And tell us about that.
Well, I think some of that varies based on the size of the city, the nature of the city, and the like. I think in Salem, for the most part, the mayor is the executive who runs the city. She runs the departments. She is the person primarily responsible for everything. Our job is to be a check on the finances, a source of ordinances. And I refer to the role of city councilor, at least in my view, especially a ward councilor like I am, as we're like the ombudsman for the citizens in our neighborhood.
Okay. Great.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, working as a ward councilor,
sure.
How does I know in Gloucester, for example, and it's not written down anywhere, but in Gloucester, the ward councils have often been the nuts and bolts people. If the sewer, the catch basin is clogged up, if the trash doesn't get picked up that day or didn't get picked up on time, the street didn't get plowed, the water pressure is, you know, those kind of issues. Is that the way it works in Salem? And tell us about that.
Well, that's pretty much the way I think of the role. Like I was saying, we're the ombudsman of the neighborhood, really. So our job is to be the people who, we're the people who run point. If you do have a problem, if there's a development issue on your corner, if there's a clogged drain, if there's a trash pickup missing, if there's a tree that needs to get trimmed or a sidewalk that needs to get repaired or a pothole, we're the guys who usually hear about it first. And I do think that that's a pretty valuable role, because government to a lot of people is kind of big and confusing and indifferent, and somebody needs to be the advocate for the people who live in the neighborhood. And I think that's our primary role, besides the role we have in being part of the city government as a whole.
Great. Okay. The marijuana, change in marijuana law has... Mm-hmm. certain impact issues for cities and towns in terms of permitting, in terms of zoning, in terms of enforcement, and some other impact issues. How is that being dealt with in Salem? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, in Salem, remember, Salem was the first community in Massachusetts to open a medical marijuana dispensary. And we have another one at the moment that actually is looking to hopefully... They hope to put one in my ward on Canal Street, and they're working with neighbors and right now to try and see if they can get consensus behind that before the city chooses to back them or not. I know they're the same people who were working up in, who were looking at something up in your town, and I guess when in your town it didn't go as well for them, another company was picked, and now they're suing everybody at hand. I'm trying to look at that as, you know, with a even hand on this one. But
yeah.
The... Marijuana as a whole was something that Salem voted very strongly in favor of, both medical and recreational. I don't really have any problem with it. It's something that, you know, I don't recall. Well, as far as I can tell, when I open up my windows, I'm pretty much the only person in my neighborhood who doesn't smoke it nowadays.
Okay.
But, you know, it's something like most people. I'm 51 years old. When I was when I was in my early 20s, I smoked it. Most of the people I knew did, and I lost interest in it probably 25, 30 years ago close to, but it's, you know, it's something I've never really had a problem with. It, from a sales perspective, I want us to have some standards for where we choose to allow recreational sales to happen. I don't want to zone it out of the city entirely or anything like that. I think that would be kind of silly, but I'd like to see some concern for possible impact locations. Really, I want to treat it like I'd be treating another package store that wants to open up.
Okay.
I think that's mainly the approach in this city so far. There are people who are absolutely dead set against it, and there are people who would love to see a dispensary on every corner, and I think most of the city generally favors it, but is somewhere in the middle.
Sure. That's great. What is the role social media plays for you in other candidates that are seeking election re-election, and what is it to what extent do you and do others deploy its use in responding to the constituency and the citizens?
Well, this is the one part where I can toot my own horn a little bit. I came into office, as I mentioned, in 2011, and that was kind of when a sea change was starting to happen in the use of social media. When I first came on board, I was basically the only city councilor that first term of mine who was using social media to any serious extent to communicate with constituents. I originally used it as an easy campaign method, and I post frequently. I have about 800 or so regular viewers of my Facebook page and some more on my website and about 500 people on my email list. And I use those tools to try and make sure people stay informed. It's something that I think is really, really important. You know, again, it gets to my, so many people see government as a black box. and I want the mystery taken out of it for most people. I want you to be able to see, like, okay, this is what your city government does. These are the issues we're dealing with. These are the things we have to vote on. This is what I'm thinking and why I'm thinking it, but I'd like to hear what you guys all have to say. And it's a really good interactive tool like that. And then there's issues I'd like to use it to get discussions going on.
Great. I know that your incumbent mayor, Kim Driscoll, is an avid user of social media, and I've often wondered if she and the Gloucester mayor have a contest of who can post the most, or if they see each other's post and if they inspire each other to post more things. But usually, if Sathathi, the mayor, or Mayor Thakin posts something, within minutes you're going to get a Facebook message that Kim posted something, and it just may happen to be that I'm subscribed to those two people among others, and it works out that way. But they certainly make good use of it, and I'm sure it helps when there's a water main breaks, or it's a fire, or there's a this or that.
And
so,
we don't have Ricotta Man here in Salem, so like you guys have up there. So we don't get to promote Ricotta Man showing up, among other things. So.
Okay. What city websites are a standard now, I guess, in showcasing what a city has to offer, drawing people to the services that a city provides, and that creates a certain demand for being updated and being current. How would you rate the city's performance doing that, and are there areas that you think that it could either their work ethic could be expanded or improved, et cetera?
Well, we have our current website has been online for a little over a year, I believe, if I have my timeline correct. The system that we have now is a big improvement on our old one. It's easier for the individual departments to manage and post. There's generally a mindset in our government, and I think in most governments, that the more information you put online and the more data you put online, the better it is for citizens. We're pretty good about it. We have some departments that sometimes lag in posting information. Usually when it's things like having to do write-ups of minutes and stuff like that that take employees in the department a decent amount of time to do before they even put it online, that tends to be our biggest shortcoming in that. And it's the case, I think, in a lot of communities. Commissions and boards have issues with that. So I don't think any city in town or town really gets that completely right, and Salem's no exception. But overall, we're pretty good at getting information to people. We use our reverse 911 system for alerts to neighborhoods and to very targeted areas. So overall, communications-wise, I think the city does a pretty good job. Not everybody takes advantage of it, unfortunately.
Well, I noticed, I've spent some time on most of the city websites, six or eight of them that we're focusing our election coverage on. And Salem in particular, a great array of documents from a planning standpoint. And they're all current. I mean, it's all within the line.
Yeah.
Most everything. And that's, I've seen other cities where the last time the community development plan was published was updated might have been 10 or 15 years ago. That's not the case there. So I compliment you certainly for not simply the website showcasing of them, but that your planning operations are current as well.
Something we've done fairly well in the last few years, too, is we've taken some of the things that normally you'd have to go dredging through a single website to find, and we've broken them out to other places.
Yeah.
With all the construction activity going on in Salem right now, we have the Building Salem website. That's done a really good job of keeping people informed on specific projects and actions that are going on. That's been a big asset. We have the Destination Salem website for our tourism and prospective residents and day trippers, and they use that. And then we have some shortcuts on the main website for prospective residents and prospective businesses. And we're trying to streamline that as a city still more, but we've made some pretty good efforts.
Salem, not something we discussed prior to this interview, but a thought comes to me, and I'll ask, is the Salem notorious, is the Halloween industry is just off the charts in terms of the number of people who show up there. any integration of that into the election cycle that you see?
Halloween is not really a big critical part of the our election cycle. Some of the campaigns will do campaigning as part of it. Candidates will sometimes walk in our Halloween parade, but that's not a major factor. For the most part, I think residents in Salem are just, you know, getting through the month and realizing that that's when a lot of our retailers make their money for the year.
Okay.
And we just, you know, we batten down the hatches and wait until it blows over.
Great. Well, thank you. I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold, and certainly wish you the very best in your upcoming election.
Sure. Thanks a lot. Glad to be on. Thank you.
Thanks, Josh.
Well, there you go. People gearing up, and they've got they want to get the message out there, don't they?
Yeah.
Tis the season. All right, so what do we have lined up in
the
future?
Next week we have Donna Lee, the City of Gloucester Human Resource Director, and we also have Sherry DiBenedetti, who is a paranormal investigator, a ghost hunter, is going to be on. We've got a couple of open slots, but we've got several people who have indicated that they are interested in being on the show, to include... Jen Holgram, a candidate for City Council at Large in Gloucester. Joseph Gigoloni will be with us, candidate for Ward 2 in Gloucester on the 25th of August. Jason Silver from Beverly, Matthew St. Hilaire from Beverly, Scott Adam Chernoff, candidate for School Committee in Gloucester, and Darren Sear, the City Council President in Lynn, as well as Jamie Figueroa, a candidate for City Council in Lynn.
Sounds good. All right, that's very busy. Don't forget, we have North Shore Sports Night on Monday nights. We have Connections. That's at 7 o'clock on Monday night. We have Connections on Thursdays at 11 a.m. And Josh Arnold's Trending Now on Fridays at 10 a.m. That's part of our live programming and football coming up about a month from now. A little more than a month from now. Have a great weekend.